Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and we're so pleased to have so many of you with us on another cold winter night here in New York City. For those of you who are guests this evening who have not been in this building before, you're now in the members' room of the Society Library, which is normally our very grand reading room. And if you come back another day, we can give you a tour of the full facility of the library. We're so pleased to have so many people here for our opening of our current exhibition, Readers Make Their Mark, Annotated Books at the New York Society Library. And first of all, I would like to express our heartfelt thanks to Romano Peluso and Ada Peluso. They have given long-standing support of the library and our gallery. The Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery outside was opened in 2008 with their help. Over the last 7 years, we've had a series of exhibitions under the leadership of our head of exhibitions, Harriet Shapiro, and we are continuing to do more exhibitions here at the library, and we're glad you're here tonight for the launch of our latest. I also want to take just a quick moment to thank the underwriters for this new exhibition, the H.W. Wiltson Foundation, New York Bound Books, represented by Barbara Cohen, who's with us tonight. Thank you, Barbara. Cohen and Taliaferro LLC, and Paul Cohen is here from that firm. Thank you, Paul. James Cummins Bookseller, Tobias Abeloff, and Marty and Lan Incorporated. They all supported this exhibition and were very appreciative of their financial help. So thank you to all the donors. It's my pleasure to introduce one of the curators of this evening's exhibition. Erin Schreiner is our special collections librarian, and she and her two co-curators are going to make some remarks to explain what our exhibition is all about tonight. So welcome, Erin.
Hi, thank you everyone for coming tonight. It's really exciting. This has been a long project. I think it started about a year ago, or a little bit longer than that, because I wrote a blog post about Tony Grafton's book. He found out about it because I had illustrated the post with a picture of an annotated book, and one of Tony's students, Madeline McMahon, my co-curator, was working on annotated ecclesiastical chronologies. And one thing sort of followed another, and one day I had a whole gaggle of Princeton graduate students and Professor Grafton and Bill Sherman in the reading room upstairs, and we realized just how much there was in the collection, and it was a really fun day for everybody, and it was just a great start to this whole thing, and so that's the origin story of why we're all here tonight. I'm just going to say a few thank yous. I'd like to thank Mark and Harriet Shapiro for supporting this exhibition from the beginning. It's not many places where you can just walk into your director's office and walk up to the head of exhibitions and say, I have this idea, what do you think? And have them say, oh, how about the next exhibition? So that this happened in such a short period of time and that I could really realize this with such brilliant people who you'll hear from soon was really exciting. I'd also like to thank Barbara Stanton because one of the main characters of this exhibition is Maymay Say, who my colleagues have heard me go on and on about because I have completely fallen under the spell of this incredible woman, and I hope that you do too. And Barbara helped to organize the donation of the Shiroff Say collection in the late 80s and early 90s when Maymay and her partner Irene Shiroff were still alive. And Barbara invited me over for coffee one day and just talked to me about Irene and Maymay. And that started the chain of realization that, oh, well, maybe I could find some of Maymay's relatives, and I did. And I'm I'd like to thank two people who couldn't be here tonight, Irene Tseng and Gar Wong, Maymay's nieces, who had long phone conversations with me and put up with tons and tons of questions, and I think they really helped to fill out what I was able to learn about Maymay Tse and what she's doing with the books that you see on display in the library. Professor Grafton also introduced me to Cynthia Huang, who, because I don't read Chinese, was able to really help me understand a lot of what Maymay was doing. And one of the most incredible things that I learned is that despite the fact that she is a Chinese American and was born in China, she only spoke sort of kitchen Chinese with her family, and so she is self-taught in classical Chinese, and everything that you see on display tonight and all the Chinese hand is, you know, evidence of her tremendously hard work, because I don't know if I could teach myself Chinese, and she did. I'd also like to thank my colleagues here at the library. Sarah Holliday and Katie Frickis have been really wonderful organizing this party tonight, so thank you to all of them for making this possible. Joris Munoz, our conservator, did a lot of really important work in all of the books that you see on display tonight. Each one of them is sitting in a cradle that he built by hand, so that's a huge labor of love. My colleagues on the fourth floor are really wonderful people who listened to me blather on about all this for a long time and edited a lot of my labels and looked at things again, as did Harriet. So thank you to them. Finally, thank you to Madeline and Frederick, who were just, in addition to being maybe some of the smartest people I've ever met, really fun to work with. Really pleasant, hilarious, just like I could not have asked for better conspirators in this project. So thank you to you two, and thank you also to Tony for leading them my way and saying, hey, you know, if you want to do this, I think these people might be perfect, because you were totally right. Frederick is a postdoctoral fellow and lecturer at Stanford currently. He received his PhD from Princeton last year. Madeline McMahon is currently a Gates Scholar at the University of Cambridge. So both of them have flown quite a distance to be here tonight, and I'm really happy that they did that. And I have just little gifts for both of you. So thank you so much. And
so first, let me just reiterate what a delight it has been to work with these fantastic materials and the wonderful staff here at the library. This project would not have been possible without the support and hard work of many hands. And I hope that we have done justice to the many hands of readers who are represented in the cases here in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery.
Thank you. This exhibition, I think, really just reflects the library's central place in the history of American literature and politics, and the city, in the history of the city that we find ourselves in, a city that has for so long been at the center of all of that. In the age of the American Revolution, this was the library of the likes of George Washington, John Jay, and Aaron Burr. And today we can even go back and see exactly what books they checked out. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, this library became a locus of literary New York. It has links to the likes of Melville, Wharton, James, Willa Cather, etc. You can even see one of a collection of Cather's annotated here. It was in this capacity that the library was not just a center of New York cultural activity, but also truly a repository of American cultural memory. And as we will discuss tonight, part of that repository reflected engagement with America's still more distant past. So I'd like to say a few words tonight about one of the true gems of this library's collection, and something that's highlighted in our exhibition, which is the Winthrop Collection. And the very fact that part of this collection ended up here reflects the library's privileged place in the life of an infant nation. In 1812, Francis B. Winthrop donated more than 200 of his family's books to the library, making available to a wider public the book collection of one of America's oldest and indeed most prominent families. Now, we remember John Winthrop Sr., one of many John Winthrops, for his famous declaration, much used and sometimes abused, for centuries to come, that when he approached the shores of Massachusetts, he was here, quote, to found a city on a hill. But before there was a city, and long before there was even a nation, there was a library. And while the Winthrops brought many more practical necessities with them on ships across the Atlantic, they also brought their books, and this is really, really important. They came with their books, and John Sr., that most famous Winthrop, his father, many of whose books are featured here, Adam Winthrop, amassed a large collection of books. And though he died in 1623, he died 7 years before his son John sailed to the New World, his books were carried long after his death to New England. And in this sense, what you see here tonight is part of, in a sense, the first library collection in English-speaking North America to be brought to this country. And this is an incredible legacy of the transmission of learning across coasts. And I also want to say that this collection was continued by, particularly by his grandson, John Winthrop Jr., and the Winthrops were not just annotators of books. They were also connoisseurs of annotation. They specifically acquired books that had been annotated by others, including, as you'll see in the cases, by the Elizabethan magus and sort of political advisor John Dee. So they were keenly, they were in a sense, they were marginalia hounds long before, centuries before this library was founded. And the sort of central, one of the central collections, the earliest collection of this library, was founded in that same sort of obsession with readers' marks that that we celebrate tonight.
So, like the Winthrop collection, the vast majority of the books that are shown in this exhibit were acquired by the library as annotated books. Many of them are also rare books, some of them centuries old, which means that they are harder to access than the books in the library's open stacks. We hope to show these incredible books to more people and let these notes speak for themselves. Each of these books tells its own story, and many of them speak to each other. To that end, we have grouped the books shown here in the four standing cases into based on their annotators' shared reasons for annotating, so response, recollection, revision, and research. Over the past five centuries, readers have annotated for all kinds of reasons: to react against a text, to make a note in order to remember an association as it occurs to them, to correct errors or improve the style of the printed writing, or to manage the information they gather while writing their own works. Yet even these broad motivations cannot define the diversity of readers' marginalia. Occasional images reimagine lost worlds, London Bridge before a fire, or the forgotten boundaries of a New England colony. Annotations also serve as the blueprint for new worlds, to make alchemical discoveries, stage a play, or even update the ever-growing catalog of this library. There is no single way to navigate this exhibit. We have provided a map to the miniature worlds in the margins on the printed pamphlet that you will see by the manicule case. You may use the index there to locate and perhaps even mark what is of interest to you and discover new connections between readers and texts across the centuries. We encourage you to write in the pamphlets and guest book, of course. By displaying these books, the library does not condone the annotation of its collection, just to be clear, but rather seeks to draw attention to the existing annotated books that contribute to the richness of that collection. When we read, we often wonder what authors meant, but in this exhibit, we want to prompt new questions about how books were read in practice. Did an American contemporary of Jane Austen's enjoy the first edition of Emma? What did George Bernard Shaw think of one of his own plays? How did generations of Winthrops read the marginalia of an Elizabethan magus in the New World? How did a student annotate his textbook in 16th century Leipzig? Annotations are clues to answering these questions. We all know here that reading changes us, A book makes its mark on a reader. We can glimpse that sea change in the marks readers make on their books.
And so we'd like to close tonight just with a few reflections on the importance and the value of these readers' marks at our present moment. As books multiply in both print and in digital form, as they beckon to us on Amazon, or as we can now easily fit hundreds, if not thousands of them, on our personal computers or e-readers, the physical library, any library in fact, may seem superfluous. After all, aren't libraries then all just copies of one another? Of course, anyone who has used a library knows that this could not be further from the truth. Books alone do not make a library. Rather, as anyone who has sat in this room knows, or in the rooms above, there is something about books and patrons, readers and writers, gathered together in the confines of a single space. It is this that has always made libraries greater than the sum of their parts. An annotation is one more thing that confirms that no two libraries will ever be alike. Go on Google Books or do a WorldCat search of any of the items in these cases, even the very rare ones, and you could easily find numerous copies, perhaps indeed in the hundreds, of any of them, perhaps even right here in this city. You can multiply an author's words in seemingly endless fashion, but a reader's words, or even their mere marks, always remain linked to the single personal book in which they read them. When taken together, books and readers in dialogue, sometimes across centuries, sometimes across continents, when taken together, they form a library. The Society Library has been privileged to host many such dialogues. And as it turns out, and as you'll see in the cases here tonight, many of these dialogues took place long, long before the actual physical founding of the library in 1754. Taken together, they illuminate the history of a city and the history of a nation. But indeed, many of these conversations took place beyond New York and even beyond the shores of the American continent. At the end of the day, it is readers' marks that preserve these conversations, and hence, as we hope to show, make each book unlike any other. Thank you so much.
So we hope you'll all stay and continue to eat and drink and enjoy the show. So thanks.